House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Wednesday, March 18th, 2015. We will open a public hearing on and possible work session on House Bill 2228.
As Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2228 is sponsored by Representatives Hoyle and Representative Gilliam at the request of the Oregon Elder Abuse Prevention Work Group. We don't have the paperwork back on the bill yet, so it's not ready to move today. We do have one proposed -1 amendment before us that clarifies language and inserts a new subsection stating that the Department of State Police may not use fingerprints, cards or facsimiles retained pursuant to the bill for any purpose other than providing information as outlined. So WRAP Back is a notification process that informs an employer or other designated entity of any subsequent arrest when an individual has already undergone a background check and their fingerprints were retained in a repository. House Bill 2288 creates a limited WRAP Back system in Oregon. It requires the Department of State Police to establish a voluntary program of fingerprint retention through which OSP retains fingerprint information received from the Federal Bureau of Investigations or created during a state criminal records check for the purpose of providing to agencies and districts subscribing to the fingerprint retention program.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Joe Greenman and Melissa Unger, please. You go in any order, please remember to identify yourself for the record.
Okay. Hi, I'm Joe Greenman, General Counsel with the Oregon Healthcare Association, and I'm also pleased to pass along that I was also a member of the Elder Abuse Prevention Work Group. We are in support, not only from the work group perspective, but also the association that I represent, of House Bill 2228. This bill will bring vast improvements to the background check process for caregivers in our licensed community settings. They're already mandated to get background checks, although the process is highly inefficient and costly, not only for state government, but for the providers who rely on state government as their partner to conduct the background checks. I think you'll probably be hearing from Jeff Aiken from the Department of Human Services to give you more detailed description of what they're up to at DHS, but currently they're in the process of administering a $3 million grant to basically get integrated with a federal system of background checks under federal legislation called the Elder Justice Act, which was passed several years ago, with the goal being that all 50 states, ultimately for the purposes of background checks for people who care for vulnerable populations, such as vulnerable adults, elders, and some of the children's settings, will be integrated into a federal national background check process so that there aren't any of these gaps that occur from a state-to-state basis in the state criminal background databases, and also create WRAP-back capability, which is real-time ongoing tracking of people so that in the event that there's new criminal background, the providers who are employing these caregivers get immediate notification of new incidences of criminal background that come into a person's record so that fitness determinations can be made for ongoing suitability of those people to continue to work in those environments. So for all those reasons, in brief, we are very strong supporters of this legislation, and I'm happy to defer to our friend Ms. Unger.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Melissa Unger, and I'm the SEIU Local 503 Political Director. We support this bill. We think it's really important for our caregivers. We represent over 25,000 caregivers, people who care for children, people with disabilities, seniors, people with developmental disabilities, and they work in homes and they work in facilities. And this bill simply streamlines the process for background checks for them. The reality is many people who do care do in different settings at the same time. So you can have some workers who are home care workers and then also work at a nursing home, some workers who work at a facility for the developmentally disabled and then are a personal supports worker, or some people who do home care and child care at night. And right now, all of those, you would need different background checks for every one of those jobs. I just talked to a nursing home worker recently who told me he got three different background checks in 6 months. And the reality is right now, either the state, the worker, or the facility is paying the cost for all of those background checks when we believe that there's an easier way to do it. And we've been working for years now. We've been part of the task forces and trying to find the money to streamline this process and find the balance that we need to streamline the background checks at the same time as protect our workers' privacy. And we feel like there's a really good balance in this bill. And we believe that it's a strong bill that is really ready to move forward with this national funding to be implemented. And I think we'll find that there will be immediate relief from all sides of this, whether it's actually saving money in the state, which it will actually save money, but also from the different facilities, from the different providers. I think everyone will find that this is a really just a way to streamline our work and the way that we provide care for hundreds of thousands of individuals throughout our community. So we're really enthusiastic supporters of it and are really excited to hopefully see this move forward finally. Thank you.
Representative Greenlee.
Yeah, I'd like to ask Ms. Unger a question. I haven't had a chance to delve into this. I'm just about to bring the bill up. But in the healthcare committee over the past five or six sessions, we've added the requirement for fingerprint checks against a variety of healthcare occupations. One of the questions we asked all the time was whether the state had the ability and the intention of keeping the fingerprints on record, and we were always assured no, that it was just to be used for an individual investigation and then it would disappear. It looks like this bill has proposals to find a way to maintain the fingerprints from everybody who comes in simply because they applied for a job. Are you at all uncomfortable about that adding of thousands or perhaps hundreds of thousands of people to a fingerprint database that have done nothing more than apply for a job?
Yeah. Chair Barker, Representative Greenlee, I think that's a good question. And, you know, Jeff Akin is going to be able to speak to some of the amendments that are being proposed to make sure that we're protecting people's privacy and their rights in this process, because I agree with you that we don't want to create a process where folks, you know, the fingerprint could be used for something else, right? They could just run it against a criminal background check database when, like, or old crime, or, you know, whatever it could be, whatever it is. The point is for this job to get a criminal background check, and we don't want to use it in any other way. But we also know that for a worker who is applying for multiple jobs, or like they need a way that they, if they got their criminal background checked once, that they don't have to continually pay for it to get it done. So I think it's a bit of a balance. But we agree that we don't want this to be a slippery slope where it's used for anything outside of the purpose for what it's supposed to be used for, which is to make sure that people have this appropriate background check at the time that they're supposed to have the appropriate background check. And so hopefully Jeff, and I know the ACLU will be testifying too, and we're working on a amendments to make sure that those issues are like that we're very comfortable with those issues, because it's a valid concern.
I'll look forward to hearing about that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Post.
Turnbark, thank you very much. I take 12 page bills and try to condense them. Probably not smart, but it helps me. Tell me if this, I think you just answered this, but tell me if this is fairly accurate. Currently, Oregon has a registry of home care workers identifying those with clean records and passed background checks for initial screening, but no way for employer to know of subsequent arrests. This bill would authorize the state to develop a system whereby potential employees voluntarily submit fingerprints to the Oregon State Police for purposes of notifying certain state agencies when an arrest occurs and matches those fingerprints. Is that accurate?
Chair Barker, Representative Post, it is accurate. Last year, under House Bill 4151, we began this process while understanding that Oregon still prohibited under state law the ability to maintain any criminal background check record. In other words, it must be destroyed as soon as it is utilized to make a fitness determination for employment. The legislature did create authority under House Bill 4151 for the department to begin to create a registry. And that would be a registry of people who are currently working and qualified to work, but it currently doesn't have any updating of their criminal background. If in fact we do remove the prohibition and allow for a consensual, voluntary opt-in process where the state can keep background checks of people on file and have real-time updating, that registry then will sort of become a go-live registry where not only are the people currently qualified, but any new information or data about their criminal background would create sort of an alert that would cause the Department of Human Services or any other vendor agency that is in partnership with the state police for the purposes of these types of employees for vulnerable populations to be able to reach out to the employer in the field and say, hey, something just came in. We need to talk about what this is, what it means, and maybe reevaluate the person's fitness to continue to provide services in this setting. Okay.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that brings up a question. What would the alert be? There's clearly a difference between arrest, and fingerprints are taken then. There's clearly a difference between arrest and a conviction. So what would that alert be? When would it be activated? And how would the hiring agency manage that, knowing this person was arrested for this terrible thing, innocent until proven guilty?
Chair Barker, Representative Springer, I'm going to answer this question, but I'm also going to sort of bookmark it for Mr. Aiken because he is the subject matter expert on this. But the direct answer to your question is, to my knowledge, it includes an arrest. So if somebody is arrested but not convicted, that will trigger sort of an incident in their criminal background that would cause the agency to contact the employer. And there are certain categories. Like, for instance, in long-term care facilities, there is a sort of a never hire category of a list of convictions that if you are convicted of one of this long list of crimes, you are permanently disqualified from being an employee in this field. And then there is a category of possible disqualifying incidents. And that includes a number of convictions and other things, including arrests. Like, for instance, if you have a number of arrests, but maybe only minor convictions, if you continue to incur arrests for various things, that's going to, at a minimum, you're going to need to have a new fitness determination in partnership with the Department of Human Services. And it may be cumulative to the point where you're looking at somebody under a fitness determination as no longer appropriate to be in this setting with this vulnerable population. And that's in that sort of intermediate category of a possible disqualification.
Follow up, okay, Mr. Please. Chair? Thank you. Switching gears just a little bit, I sit on Ways and Means, and we look at budgets of the little boards, very small boards. Some of them have budgets of less than $1 million. And one of the frequent conversations in that committee is the background check piece, which costs $24.50, unless that has changed. And if an agency or somebody conducting that wants to charge more, they can, but that's what it actually costs to have done. So is that what we're looking to save, is that $24.50 for either the person or the agency?
Chair Barker, Representative Springer, without knowing specifically what kind of background checks they are, it's hard for me to completely address that. What I'll tell you is, in our setting, we have two different types of background checks that occur. And this is one problem in our system as it currently stands that ultimately getting to a wrap-back system will fix. And that is, we have a system that everybody who either is a new hire or gets a promotion or changes position or changes employers gets a new background check. And then they're on a little bit of an honor test, because the breakdown works this way. If they live in the state of Oregon 5 years or longer, they're submitted to a LEDS check, which is a state-only criminal background check, in Oregon only. And it has some other criminal background check information, but it's not thorough and comprehensive. And if they say they've lived in Oregon 5 years or less, or that there's possible other criminal records in there that would cause the need to have a different test, then they roll prints and they're sent through the Oregon State Police into the FBI system. My understanding is that the cost of that rolled print state police through the FBI system is more and possibly significantly more than 2450. I've always heard numbers in the past that were, significantly higher than that 2450 mark when the department has quantified the actual cost of the FBI national check for those folks. In our system, state government shoulders the cost because it's done via Medicaid contractors, and so the state actually gets a federal match for conducting that background check. So some of the cost is offset by a federal state cost-sharing mechanism, but for any sort of private vendor, I think they would, if they wanted to use get a national check through the DHS system, they'd have to pay DHS the cost of shouldering that check, which I think means that DHS doesn't run background checks for anybody unless they're a Medicaid contractor with the department.
Question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joe, do you know how many other states have a similar policy like this?
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, I do know, Jeff Akin will probably blow me out of the water on this. A number of states have received the grant, and I know that I've heard at least Michigan has gone all the way and created a wrap-back system. They've always been the state that has been described to me as the state that has gone furthest and quickest down the line to actually create this system.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jeff Akin and Patricia Whitfield.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Akin. I'm the National Background Check Program Manager with the Department of Human Services. And some fantastic questions so far. I prepared some testimony that I think is going to address most everything that's been asked so far and very likely spark some more questions. So I'll kind of dig down. And I have Tricia Whitfield here with the Department of State Police. If there are any specific questions on the operation of the system or our relationship with the FBI and how the pieces tie together. So as Joe eloquently put, House Bill 2228 is the result of a collaborative work effort, the Oregon Elder Abuse Prevention Work Group. And the bill is meant to accomplish four specific things. First is develop the wrap-back system. Joe did a good job of describing what that is. We have a limited wrap-back system in place today for law enforcement officers, peace officers, individuals with access to criminal records. It's a relatively manual process, and it's for a very small, specific group of people. And there was a question earlier around arrests being what the notifications are predicated upon, and that is correct. As a law enforcement system, it's fingerprint-based and driven so that when the individual is fingerprinted upon arrest, there'll be a notification through the system that provides positive identification of the individual. Now, in the 2013 session, there was a bill, House Bill 3168. It's now ORS 181.547. Tells DAS to write rules that essentially establish criteria for background checks. What's your pass-fail criteria in there? This bill in no way changes the criteria for what's done. It just provides the notification of the arrest. Agencies who have access to that information would then need to basically use that arrest in accordance with the criteria set in those rules. So as an example, Joe did mention that there are some states. Minnesota has a wrap-back, Alaska, Oklahoma, Illinois. I believe there are 8 or 9 that have established full wrap-back systems. There are 23 states, including Oregon, that are participating in this grant that was referenced earlier. But in those states where they receive the arrest notification, what happens is they get that. The first question that they have to answer is this a person that we are truly interested in? In this case, the Department of Human Services would contact the employer. Is person X still there? Essentially confirm that they're still, we have an interest in them and want to see their criminal record. And if that's the case, then we confirm that with the FBI, the state police, and then have access to that criminal record. So the next question is, do we care about that crime? It may be a violation. It may be something that is not potentially disqualifying. If that's the case, you're done. There are no more steps to be taken. After that, you fall to your criteria. So what happens in Minnesota, I can speak to specifically. I've spent a number of hours on the phone with them and how their system is put together. And they essentially babysit that arrest through the court process. And once it's dispositioned, If it's dismissed, they're done. If it's a conviction, it then goes up against their criteria for a pass-fail on a background check. And so that similar process would be done here in Oregon. The second thing it's meant to do is allow for the retention of fingerprints. Now, safety, privacy, security are absolutely primary key considerations in this. There is an amendment, the Dash 1 amendment, that is currently available that will not allow the prints to be used for any other purposes other than wrap back. I also expect an additional amendment through collaboration with the ACLU. Specifically, we want to ensure that before an individual enrolls in the wrap-back system, they've had full disclosure notification of what that means. They know what the process is to opt out of the system if they no longer want their fingerprints retained. And then just a few other pieces to ensure that the communication between Oregon State Police and the FBI provides protections at both the state and the federal levels. The third thing is to allow agencies to participate in the system voluntarily. So any state agency that currently processes fingerprint-based criminal records checks through the Department of State Police will be able to take advantage of the system, but the bill is in no way meant to mandate that they do. And finally, the individuals that are background checked or kind of overseen by those agencies that are participating, this system would be voluntary for them. Oregon is unique amongst the other states that have implemented these wrap-back systems in that we are looking to make this voluntary for the individuals. We do not intend on mandating people to enroll in this, and that's where the disclosure and the opt-out pieces that we're working with the ACLU to plug in become very critical. We also, in that caveat in the bill, it's explicitly stated that participation in the system cannot be a condition of employment. And again, I put it here, and it's super critical to point out to make sure it's understood, but the bill does not change what is used or how it is used in a background check. It changes the timing and the method in which agencies learn of new criminal records information. As Joe stated, today we rely on either self-disclosure or, as a personal favorite, when I was with the agency's background check unit, where we'd receive a background check request with a photocopy of Busted magazine in the person's mugshot saying, "We want a new background check because of this." The continuous evaluation or wrap-back essentially replaces the need for either of those disclosures to happen. And to build on what Joe said about House Bill 4151, operationally, the wrap-back system is the next phase in this process. That Bill 4151 did a number of things, but specifically for purposes of this, was aimed at reducing excessive background checks in the long-term care industry. As of yesterday, we have 12,763 individuals enrolled in that system, and 412 of those individuals have avoided duplicative background checks. In other words, they've worked for more than one employer, as Melissa stated in her testimony. And so they've avoided that extra background check as a result of that system. Now today, because there's not a wrap back, every 2 years, those individuals have to go through a full background check once again, kind of making sure there hasn't been anything we haven't been made aware of. And to put that in perspective, this system through House Bill 4151 went live in January, 3 months. So we know that in 2 years from just these 3 months, the Department of Human Services will run 12,763 background checks in addition to any new checks that are coming through for new employees or other people changing positions. The wrap-back system that House Bill 2228 would allow us to create will nearly eliminate those rechecks and give immediate notification of activities that could place vulnerable people in jeopardy. There was a question around the cost of things and savings there. I hope that piece addressed the savings to be had to a level. And then the system itself will cost money to build. We don't have the exact numbers on that yet, but in 2012, DHS was awarded a grant from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to support the development and testing of the wrap-back system, and much of the cost of the system development will be paid for by the grant. Now, the Department of State Police, and Tricia can speak more to this if you have questions on there, asked the FBI to weigh in on the language. Anytime that we touch our enabling statutes to process fingerprints through the FBI, we're required to have them review that language and make sure it's in alignment with their statutes. And I understand we're still waiting on some specific feedback from them that will lead to a future amendment to ensure that we're aligning our language and our needs with what they need, so that we can actually plug into the federal wrap-back system. So that concludes my testimony, and happy to answer.
Any questions? I have a couple. So if I opt to not get into the program, and then I need some more background checks, do I still, who pay, I mean, does it pay?
Good question, Chair Barker. Today, the state would pay for that background check.
Okay. And then my other comment would be, I mean, unless it's a pretty serious crime, at least in my experience, was people didn't get fingerprinted. I mean, drunk drivers just get to go home, and although there is a bill to require them to be fingerprinted within 5 days this time around, but so a lot of people aren't fingerprinted for theft and so on. It's been years, I think, since anybody in Port Shoplifter gets taken in to jail. I mean, just get a ticket and get to go. So, a lot of people that would, I mean, there you'd have a lot of people where you might have concerns if somebody's a thief, but I don't know. I mean, I don't want to mandate the police fingerprint everybody either, so please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll confess, this is about a half-baked question. It says in here that the fingerprints can't be used for any other purpose, but the fingerprints would be subject to subpoena.
Chair Barker, Representative
Springer. Let me reiterate, that's a half-baked question.
Yes.
I'm trying to think that through.
I do not have the expertise to answer that question, though, but I can definitely look in. I don't know if you would know anything.
I'd like an answer to that.
About that.
Yeah, there would be.
Not specific to.
Oh, Mr. Redfield, go ahead. Oh,
yeah, I can do some research and confirm that for you.
Yeah,
I'd be
it's
happy
not ready
to.
Obviously not ready today anyway. Please go ahead.
Yeah.
Good afternoon. For the record, Patricia Whitfield, Oregon State Police Criminal Justice Information Services Division. And while OSP doesn't have a formal position on the bill, we do serve an important role in the background check process, and happy to answer any questions that we can that come along. I also don't have prepared testimony, but I just wanted to highlight, and I apologize if any of it's duplicated to what you heard before, but as the state repository for Oregon for criminal offender record information, my division does create and maintain criminal histories based on fingerprint arrests. So arrests that take place in the state of Oregon are all submitted to our agency for maintaining and creating those records. And to the question maybe earlier about who all gets fingerprinted, Oregon law requires that all felony arrests and any sex and drug misdemeanor arrests are required to be reported to the repository. So other crimes are not. However, we do accept and maintain other misdemeanor crimes if they are submitted. Criminal history isn't complete. It starts with the arrest and the fingerprints. We search those fingerprints against the existing file, and if there is an existing record, it gets added to their account, as I sometimes say, and creates a criminal history. If there is no previous record, then a new record is created. Subsequently, our hope is that the court disposition would be married up to that event so that there is, again, that additional information about the criminal history that law enforcement uses and then agencies such as DHS to make their decisions. The current criminal history database is about 1.7 million fingerprints, and those records are confidential, and they are to be used primarily for the purpose of law enforcement criminal justice. But there have been a number of bills and authorities given by the legislative body to agencies such as Department of Human Services and others that have made their case that they are tasked with regulating programs that might protect vulnerable citizens or even public property. So OSP's role in terms of this bill is, again, we are the service provider for those background checks. When it is a fingerprint check, we are the go-to. We are also the facilitator to make that happen at the national level. So today, it's very common for agencies to submit electronically their fingerprints to us with the intent of us providing them back the results of both the state and the FBI check. There is a fee for both of those checks. Because of the partnership or the relationship that we've had with the FBI and their programs, particularly the National Fingerprint File Program, we are, and each of the states are the keepers of the state records. The FBI doesn't duplicate them at the national level, but they have an index, if you will, one set of fingerprints of which to match subsequent information to. And that mirrors, that's what we do at the state level. At the federal level, again, they just have the one index. And if there is interest in that particular record for an authorized purpose, then they're going to refer that entity to the state. The retention of applicant fingerprints has been prohibited for the most part for these regulatory programs. There are a few private investigators, private security officers, polygraph examiners that we are allowed to retain those prints, very small population. But in essence, the background checks that we're doing for agencies such as DHS is a snapshot. They're giving us the fingerprints, asking, please tell us, does this person have any activity that they would weigh in on, whether they are appropriate for the position or some sort of licensing. They are authorized by this body to have the entire criminal history once a fingerprint check is done, because that's our way to validate that it belongs to that applicant, not just the other John Smith or so on. So it's unique that they have been authorized to get that full criminal history. If we are able to effect an identification through one of those indexes at the national level, we do not need to transmit the fingerprints to or request a specific FBI record. We have the ability and the delegated authority to provide that FBI check to the state agencies and therefore not incur a cost for the FBI fee. We would just charge the Oregon fee, if that makes sense. The retention of fingerprints for applicants has been a topic of discussion for a number of years now, with some efforts made by state agencies and some other previous legislation. There's also a national interest by a lot of parties to also see some efficiencies, and efficiencies mainly being that applicants don't have to go through repeat background checks time and time again. It might not eliminate in every case the need for another set of fingerprints depending on what options are used, but it definitely does add some level of efficiencies that we don't have today, but does require that those prints be on file as a placeholder, if nothing else, at the state level and the FBI level to be able to report back that activity of interest. So the state agencies that have the authority today, when they get the results of a criminal history, are very much so looking at arrest information and conviction information and anything that's on a criminal history. So the same kinds of rules and policies would apply to them to use this notification of new information coming in as a result of an arrest. Privacy, I know, has been a big balancing act that we heard earlier today, and at the national level, I know that that's of great interest in making sure that the applicants are aware of the process, and the timing and the results back is of great interest, and I know that's an evolving thing. At the national level, I've actually just started the implementation process of a wrap-back process, so that is new for states. As Jeff mentioned, there are a number of states that have had an in-state only wrap-back, which, again, is limited to what's happening within your state. This is the first time, really, that it's opened up to a national initiative. In terms of implementing this particular bill, if it were passed, it in large part would be similar to what we do now with the background checks, but obviously it would change things for us to retain those prints. We would use the infrastructure and the workflow that we have in place now, but it would require that OSP would manage these subscriptions. So the bill talks about agencies subscribing to the notification if their applicants voluntarily allow the fingerprints to be retained. So there would be some of that kind of activity, but a lot of it's unknown, so we don't have all of that put together. But that's in a very hopefully high-level overview what OSP's role would be in this, and happy to answer any questions that I can.
So, one of the questions I have, so today John Smith gets arrested for shoplifting, isn't fingerprinted, and it shows up. I don't know how that, exactly how that works. But so then you're not going to notify everybody that has a John Smith that's on. How would that work?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, that's a good question. And if I understand correctly, the applicants that voluntarily allow their prints to be retained, that is going to be tied to the agencies that they are applying for. And there's quite a bit of thought into the process and options of making sure that not everybody gets notified. It's a very clear direct that this is the agency that's subscribing and is interested in this particular applicant, and they're only authorized at that time to get that information. If the applicant maybe has a completely change, different thought and change of career, that they're no longer of interest, then part of that mechanism is to unsubscribe. That agency doesn't get that notification.
But I'm asking, so somebody isn't fingerprinted today, but they're arrested, do you still notify if you, I mean, how would you know that it's the Jeff Barker to notify my employer that I had done something?
And I'm not positive that I do understand your question. I'm sorry. Today we don't have the fingerprints retained, so we do not know. There is no notification. It is one time you know, and you don't know what kind of activity until you renew.
But if I got arrested today and I didn't, was not fingerprinted in that arrest, and you wouldn't know. And so it just shows up that, I mean, you might see that Jeff Barker was arrested, but
Chair Barker, members of the committee, correct. We would not have that means. I know that the background check that we do is one part of the check that agencies do, so they might see it in another fashion, but you're right. We would only be able to report what is reported to us.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Other questions? Representative Krieger?
Well, certainly what she said, but you mentioned 1.7 million background checks.
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, the database for criminal histories is 1.7. So arrest fingerprint cards, that's the database total, not the number of background checks done.
What was the source of all those? The thing is, how many might be for someone making an application for concealed carry, someone else has an agency that is trying to get a, you know, check a background on a person, and then what part of that is retained?
Chair Barker, and Representative Krieger, I can get the breakout for how many of those records are applicants and how many of them are criminal, if that's what you're needing. But you're right, there are concealed handgun permit applicants are also retained, as are the private security, private investigator type of, and I can get you that number.
Please do.
Mm-hmm.
Anything further? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kimberly McCullough.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Kimberly McCullough, and I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. I'm here to express some concerns about House Bill 2228, but before I do that, I want to take a moment to acknowledge the fact that several of the stakeholders behind this bill have been particularly responsive in listening to my concerns, in particular Jeff Aiken, who you heard from earlier, Twyla Lawson at the Department of Administrative Services, and Representative Hoyle's policy advisor, Lindsay Baker, have met with me numerous times to help educate me about this bill and also to work on some potential amendments to the bill that would alleviate at least some of our concerns. I'd also just like to acknowledge that the importance of protecting vulnerable populations, and so I do understand the motivations behind this bill and appreciate them. That said, the reason that we're concerned about this bill is because the ACLU is particularly concerned about the government's collection, retention, and use of biometric data about members of the public, particularly where those individuals have not been arrested or convicted of a crime. In particular, we're very concerned about the federal government's collection of that biometric information, and the FBI has what it's called the Next Generation Identification Project, and this is essentially would be feeding into that project. And by the FBI's own words, NGI is a state-of-the-art biometric identification services system with the goal of amassing detailed profiles on Americans using electronic finger and palm prints, photos with face recognition technology, iris scans, tattoos, etc., all linked to the names, associations, residence history, criminal history, and employment of individuals. So the FBI's goal is to create this nationwide database essentially on everyone, and this would be feeding into that system. For that reason, we oppose these types of large-scale collections generally. We're also concerned, we also know that the legislature, that this legislature is also concerned about this and has been concerned about this for a number of years. And that's why if you look at this bill, it includes the language of our current statutes, which do not allow retention by the state government, by Oregon State Police, and also very specifically articulate that the FBI should not retain those prints as well. So basically what happens is the prints go to OSP, and from OSP they go to the FBI. FBI does the check and returns the check, right? And at that point they're supposed to destroy those records at the FBI level. They then destroy the records at the state level. Now, granted, we can't control what the FBI does, but if you look at the way that the language in the bill reads, it says that if we become aware that the feds are actually keeping this information, that we will no longer send them fingerprints for these checks. And that is because of a concern about exactly this type of thing. Now, as written in the bill right now, it states that OSP would retain the prints. It doesn't say anything about whether the feds would retain the prints, and that was something that became somewhat disconcerting to me, and so I did a bit of research on it and realized that the way that the system is described, if you go to CMS's website and the FBI's website, is that the FBI does retain these prints, and that's how they do the matching, right? They do the matching at the FBI level. When they get those prints, it becomes a subscription, and then they look for matching records, and when they get the matching records, then they push it out to OSP. It goes automated through the OSP system and then to the agency. And so in order for the system to actually work, this bill as written is going to need to be amended, and not something that I'd suggest, but that it's going to need to be amended in order to actually make that work to allow the FBI to retain those records. So that's going to conflict with what's already in law. So that's a bit of a concern for us. In addition, we're also concerned about the impact that criminal records can have in an ex-offender's ability to reintegrate into society and live a productive life. So we do have concerns about just background checks generally. We do understand, however, that there are certain situations like these vulnerable populations where the legislature obviously wants to do those types of things. But we also are concerned about arrest records and the impact that that can have on a person who has not yet been convicted of a crime. And the way that this system works, my understanding is that it won't work unless it reports arrests. And so that is part of this system and something that we're concerned about. That said, if this ship is sailing, if this is going to happen, we do want to be a resource and a partner for making improvements to the bill and improvements that we think will at least lessen our opposition to it. We do also want to acknowledge that if this bill does pass with those protections, because Oregon would be the first state doing this sort of voluntary program. If we do make robust protections in the bill, it could potentially set precedent for other states to follow suit. I want to highlight some of the issues specifically about the bill that we have been discussing. Some have already been discussed, so I won't repeat them. For example, the use by the Oregon State Police and the notice requirements. Also, I want to draw your attention to Section 1 of the bill, where it specifically says that the fingerprint program. So they're going to establish a fingerprint program where the department retains fingerprint cards or creates facsimiles of fingerprints received from the FBI, and then it says, or created during a criminal records check under these statutes, and those are the statutes that that we're talking about that relate to these agencies getting the checks. I'm concerned about the fact that this says they're retaining fingerprint cards or facsimiles received from the FBI. My understanding is that the purpose of this program is to collect and retain the prints of the people who are getting background checks. But the way this is written, it sounds like they're also authorized to then get fingerprints from the FBI and add them to the repository. I don't think that's intended, but it's just something that is a concern that I think that we should be looking at. I also want to point to Section 2, where it talks about the Section 2 here is not Section 2, excuse me, Sub 2 of Section 1, where it's talking about it says when the department receives forms containing fingerprints and other identifying information under ORS 181.511, and that's like what that's referring to is when you get arrested and it creates a print record, or for any other purpose related to the administration of criminal justice, the department shall determine whether the person has voluntarily chosen to participate in the program. And then if you look at the subsection 3, it clarifies that that information in subsection 2 is what gets communicated to the agency. So the way this is written, the reason I'm concerned about this is that it's not only is it arrest records that relate to the state of Oregon, but it also says anything that's reported that relates to the administration of criminal justice would then be given to the agency. My understanding is that that language is broad because it's supposed to essentially cover information that could be received from other jurisdictions related to arrest or conviction. And I'm just concerned that with it, the language being so broad, it could potentially reach, if information was reported to OSP or put into the system that related to somebody being investigated, right, and that was associated with a fingerprint, and that gets into the system, then under the way that this is written, that would end up getting pushed out to the agency as well. Obviously, we're concerned about arrests. We're much more concerned even than that about investigation or other types of information. So those are some of the things that I just think could be clarified. The statute could be changed to get it to specifically say what we're trying to accomplish or what they're trying to accomplish. My last outstanding issue is just the FBI has, my understanding is they've looked at this bill and they have concerns with this bill and they're going to come back with their suggested amendments. And my feeling is, based on what we understand about what they want to do, they may essentially include the kitchen sink in their suggestion. That concerns me. And so I just, again, I want to be a resource and work with the other stakeholders to try to make sure that we don't roll back Oregon's particularly generous privacy protections. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate you working with the others. And try to get, anybody have any questions? Ms. McCullough. Thank you very much. See if he's in the hall. You might run to the bathroom. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2228. And I'm going to open the bill. Representative Gomberg is here to testify on House Bill 2693. For anybody in the audience, this is a bill that creates the crime of encouraging sexual assault of an animal. If you want to listen to that, now would be the time to leave.
So, Chair Parker.
Yeah, except for the committee.
Chair Parker, members of the committee.
I have to open a public hearing on House Bill 2693.
Okay. Chair Parker, members of the committee. House Bill 2693 is sponsored by Representative Gomberg. We're waiting for the paperwork on this bill at present. We don't have any amendments before us today. So the sexual assault of an animal is already a crime in Oregon. However, current law does not address related activities, including the creation or purchase of visual recordings depicting animal sexual assault. And I'll let you guys take it there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, David Gomberg, House District 10 on the Central Coast. And I know this committee often deals with difficult and delicate subjects, and I appreciate your efforts and your attention to these issues. The measure I have before you today is one of those such topics, the sexual abuse of animals, a bill that that I introduced at the request of the Oregon Humane Society. And it's one of those things we don't talk about very much. We don't think about it very much, and I think as a consequence of that, perhaps a proper consequence, I don't think most of us have much sense of the nature of the problem, the scope of the problem, certainly not the practice of the problem. What I hope you'll notice about the legislation that we brought to you today is the focus on digital recordings, taking pictures of stuff, and how that leads to commercial distribution of those materials. I hope that you would also take note of some of the studies and evidence that is available that says that animal porn is very closely related to kitty porn. That is to say that not everybody that sells kitty porn sells animal porn, but we have evidence that virtually everybody that sells animal porn does sell kitty porn. The other topic of consequence is the relationship between animal sexual abuse and sexual violence among humans. And the evidence that when there is forced sexual abuse, that one of the most requested activities involves the use of animals, another unfortunately related topic. Those are the key points that I wanted to share with you. I wanted to bring you this bill because I think it's an important topic and a growing problem. And that said, I wanted to turn the rest of our time and your attention to Ms. Harmon from the Oregon Humane Society.
Thank you, Ms. Harmon.
Thank you, Representative Gomberg, Representative Barker, members of the committee. I'm Sharon Harmon. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Humane Society, an independent Oregon animal welfare organization unaffiliated with any national or other local group. This is the third bill that we've supported to ban the practice or otherwise eliminate the practice of bestiality. And the first couple of times we tried to bring this up for attention, it really wasn't taken seriously. It was dismissed. But now with the internet, unfortunately, you get to see the scope and the depravity of this practice. When we find these videos online, we would like to take action. We would like to close the loop on the connection between animal abuse and child abuse and violence against women. These are all linked crimes. We would like to see this practice stopped. It's not harmless, it's not fun, it's depraved, it's harmful, and it's often lethal on the animals. That's my testimony, and I would appreciate your support in voting yes on House Bill 2693.
Representative Krieger.
I don't know if a legislator should be subjected to this type of legislation twice, but I can remember in 2001, Joanne Bowman was sitting next to me. It was about the second day we were in this committee, and we had a bestiality bill. They were discussing things that I wouldn't discuss between two guys in an open hearing, and I kept sliding lower and lower my chair. Pretty soon she kicks me. And that was kind of my introduction to some of the things that do go on.
Mm-hmm.
There are sick and deprived minds regarding this issue, and it looks, and most of these activities are illegal.
Mm-hmm.
What you're talking about is the recording of these things and then posting them out there. I would just caution, there may be some animal husbandry things that through veterinarians or people who are breeding animals for certain characteristics, livestock, that mm-hmm. might be looking at some things with animals that might, I don't want that to fall into here.
Thank you for those comments, Chair Barker, Representative Krieger. I understand your point precisely. I think that the legislation here has some very, very clear definitions of what kind of activity that we're talking about so that it does not cross over into any effect on normal animal husbandry practices.
Representative Williamson.
More a comment than anything else. I want to thank you both for being here and for making the connection between this kind of activity and child abuse and sexual violence, because I think often people look at it, the bestiality or this bill, and think that it's, you know, something we shouldn't be dealing with. But it, the connection between this and abusing children and abusing sexual partners is tremendous. And so thank you for making sure that we knew that connection.
Representative Barker, Representative Williamson, it's not that the humans are always willing partners in this. Often women are forced into it, children are forced into it. It's just twisted and sick. There's no other way to say it. And then these are videos are produced, they're for sale, they're for trade. Yes.
Thank you. Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's no question about the legality of these acts. They're illegal. The Oregon Supreme Court's been issued pretty broad room to deal with the question of freedom of speech. Is this going to turn into a constitutional discussion as to whether selling these videos are a violation, are protected?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlee, members of the committee, I don't think you'll find stronger advocates of our freedoms than the two of us sitting here at the table today, but I think if you look at the parallels that we've tried to follow in terms of pornography involving children, that we're addressing it in much the same way, so that we can very carefully work within and protect the freedoms that are established while addressing very precise problems.
Well, I'm not dealing with whether it ought to be protected or not. You and I will agree about that. I'm just wondering whether the Supreme Court will, which has had a pretty broad definition of freedom of speech, whether it's likely to turn into a constitutional issue.
Thank you again for that question. I would simply say that smarter minds than mine have said that kiddie porn is unacceptable, and we're trying to address this exactly the same way.
No question about kiddie porn, but have there been any decisions in this area by the courts?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlee, sadly, I have no doubt that there will be an opportunity for a challenge in the near future. This is not a rare practice, and if there is an opportunity, it will be soon. I have no doubt.
Thank you.
Representative Krieger again.
I would assume if there was an obvious constitutional question, legislative counsel would attach their little note to it that tells us that the bill may be challenged at that time. You didn't get that?
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, no.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I looked in OLIS. Did you include that some of those surveys, some of that research, or did I miss it? Because I was trying to find some just real quick. I don't doubt the validity of it, but I would like to look at it.
Thank you, Chair Barker, Representative Springer. I'm sorry, no, we didn't include those documents in OLIS, but we can get you some backup material.
That would be great. Follow-up, Mr. Chair? Thank you. The other thing that we didn't talk about that this bill does is elevate the crime of sexual assault of an animal from a Class A misdemeanor to a C felony. And I just, as we look at that, I think we want to think about what we're doing, because now we're looking at a prison population issue, not just a jail population issue with that piece. And the ORS lists a lot of things that you can do, and it covers some of those areas, Representative Krieger, that you were talking about. I'll just leave it there. I've actually investigated crimes like this.
Hey, Representative Post.
Thank you, Chairman Barker. I'm sorry, Representative Gomberg, that I was called out and didn't get to hear your testimony, so I'll watch it later on. So if I ask you something that's already been covered, forgive me. Representative Gomberg and I served together on rural communities, and we have a common question we like to ask a lot, and I don't think it's here, is it?
No, there, Mr. Chairman, Representative Post, I don't believe you'll find an emergency clause
Thank
on
you.
This bill.
We have a little thing about the emergency clause. The thing that I was thinking about as I was reading the bill today and studying it some more was, if I understand it, I just want to clarify, make sure. It's relating to images. That would be part one. And then maybe how many cases that we – how rampant is this, I guess, is what I would get at part two. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Post, our office has an investigations division. We have two commissioned police officers and a non-commissioned investigator. We serve the state of Oregon. We also serve other law enforcement agencies. We have two current cases right now, not involving images, but the practice. One of them was brought in by another law enforcement agency for assistance. They needed a necropsy exam on the deceased pet to find evidence whether this really happened or not. I can go back and find that information in terms of the number of cases we have in a year's time, but there's always seems to be, out of the 1,200 cases we investigate every year, there always seems to be one current case at any time in our office alone.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so I want to make sure I just heard. So you said the act is what you're talking about. I'm saying the this idea of the images, because the act is already illegal, is it not?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Post, yes, it is.
Okay, so this is going to address images of the act.
And it's also
yes.
Okay, I want to make sure I'm clear on that.
And Representative, also it makes encouraging illegal. So if you have, this has to do with people having a farm where you can come in and have sex with the animals and film it. Representative Barton, did you have a question?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I pass. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I know. Good move.
We had a similar bill about 6 years ago, and fortunately, I didn't have to show the film. People agreed to vote for it. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Roger Beyer, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer, here representing the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. I think Representative Krieger may have already gotten my concerns on the record, but I just want to make sure that normal practice of animal husbandry would not be included in this definition. Under current law 167.310, we have a definition of good animal husbandry already listed, but is limited, is includes but not limited to certain practices. The practice of preg testing or artificial insemination are not listed in that list. I believe the list covers it because it does say including but not limited to, but I just wanted to make sure it was very clear on the record that animal husbandry practices on a dairy farm would not be considered, and if they were, for instance, filming an animal husbandry practice on a dairy farm for purposes of training or something like that, it would not be included in this definition.
It's pretty clear in here, Mr. Barr, that it says for the purpose of arousing or gratifying the sexual desire of a person. So animal husbandry, we'll make sure to put that on the record to make it so there. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt as it is, but we will, whoever carries the bill, have to be sure that that's set on the floor for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Meyer?
I guess I'm glad you said that, because if one form of this arouses, how do we know that doesn't, I guess, is the question.
Well,
I would add.
I mean, in order to prosecute that, you're going to have to prove that.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's beyond reasonable doubt. And I don't believe there's a district attorney in the state that would try to be funny with something like this.
Okay.
I mean, so I can't imagine.
You have to prove intent.
Yeah, and the intent, you have to prove the intent.
Okay.
So anything further? Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Meyer.
You.
Okay, this bill's not ready to go, so we will close the hearing on 2693 and thank the witnesses for their testimony on that.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Yes, you could, certainly.
Could we ask the drafter, the LC drafter of this, a question about freedom
sure.
of speech issues? That would be helpful.
You could have staff do it for us.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I want to actually, I think Representative Greenlee's raising the issue is not trivial. It's a pretty legitimate issue, and I think we all are on the same page and want to make sure we do it in a way to at least maximize the probability it withstands scrutiny.
Yeah. Maybe it's just strange things.
The next, I have a
just unbelievable
informational an overview of animal law. Jacob Cammons and Scott Heiser, please.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I could, I don't know that this question will be answered right at the moment, but to put it on record, when you look at the ORS of sexual assault of an animal, there is a provision, and I just put it away, that talks about psychiatric examinations after that. Would this fall into that piece? I think we need to seal that up because that's something that happens, sounded like does happen in response to this crime, in response to the crime of sexual assault of an animal. So would this indeed fall under that same level?
I don't know. My staff will check that. Please, go ahead and identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Scott Heiser. I am a former Oregon prosecutor with 17 years of experience in the trenches as a DA. I served almost three terms, as an elected DA. I now work for a nonprofit called Animal Legal Defense Fund, assisting law enforcement and prosecutors with animal cruelty cases here in Oregon and around the country. And Jake, why don't you go ahead?
Thanks. Good afternoon, Representative Barker, members of the committee. My name is Jake Kamens. I am Oregon's first animal cruelty deputy district attorney, and I have a lot to tell the committee about that. I've been a prosecutor since I graduated from law school in 2009, first at the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, and then since September of 2013 as this statewide position.
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding you wanted 5 minutes on what is animal law. First of all, for those of you that are members of the bar, have been to law school, there's actually a case book now on animal law, in case you weren't aware of that. But animal law is, in essence, the study of the statutes, cases, and regulations in which the nature, be it legal, social, or biological, of a non-human animal is at issue or an important factor in the analysis. So that's painting with a pretty broad brush. Some common examples of what animal law is include veterinary malpractice cases and the damage issues that come up in that context, custody disputes and dissolution proceedings where folks who are separating or fighting over a companion animal, and the standard that the court would use to decide the placement of that animal, housing issues involving the American Disabilities Act and service animals, simple damages cases for conversion and replevin and wrongful death or injury to pets, injury to livestock, the enforceability of estate planning as well, whether or not when somebody passes, the provisions for their pet are enforceable. Of course, there's the animal cruelty piece of it, which you heard a portion of today in the context of bestiality, the world that Jake and I work in, animal fighting, animal neglect, animal hoarding, animal sexual assault, affirmative acts of abuse, and what have you. Another common area where animal issues come up is domestic violence, protective orders, the FAPA abuse prevention orders, family abuse prevention orders, where the court now in Oregon has the express authority to include the animals as part of the order to protect them from an abuser and ensure that there's no contact. Obviously, there are a number of federal statutes that come into play when one studies this discipline, including the Animal Welfare Act being the obvious example, the Endangered Species Act, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, the Wild and Free Roaming Horses Burrows Act, and at the federal level, there's a crush video statute that addresses some of the same issues that just came up on the previous bill as well. As I mentioned, there's a casebook. Back in 2000, the year 2000, there were only 9 law schools that had any sort of instruction on animal law. As of last year, there were over 140 law schools accredited by the ABA that taught animal law in some form. So the growth has been substantial. And in case you didn't know this, right up in Portland, Lewis and Clark Law School has a Center for Animal Law Studies that I know counsel for this committee knows well. They published the first and only, it was the only for a while, but it was the first and is the first animal law review on issues dedicated exclusively to animal issues. And they also have a Center for Animal Law Studies there now that is funded with outside money, and they're offering now the first LLM degree in animal law, and it's the first in the country. So that's a nutshell overview of animal law, and I think you wanted to hear from Jake next. Thank you.
Well, as you talk about that, we just give a brief overview of how you happened to be hired there. I got last year I was sitting on the beach in Maui, and I got a call from a newspaper wanting to know about your job. So if you just briefly give us an overview of
Absolutely.
So
yes, that's part of the presentation that I prepared here. I just want to pull this up and see if it works, but I can start talking as it is. I come to this job as a prosecutor first. As I said, when I came out of law school, I went straight to the Multnomah County DA's office, worked up through the ranks there until I was at the felony property level, and then I got the opportunity of a lifetime to take on this very interesting, very special caseload. Animal cruelty prosecution, obviously you've already heard a little bit about the link between domestic violence and violence against people and violence against animals. The legislature itself did a great job illuminating a little bit of the reasoning why we have these laws in place a couple years ago in Senate Bill 6 passed, saying that animals are sentient beings capable of experiencing pain, stress, and fear, and that it's the intention of the legislature to do whatever it can to make sure that they're cared for in ways that recognize that. There's information all over about the link, and I don't need to talk too much about it because I'd like to talk a little bit about how I got involved in this and what this position is. So I've been doing this since September of 2013. The way that the position works is this. Animal Legal Defense Fund came up with grant money to fund the position. They entered into a memorandum of understanding with the Oregon District Attorney's Association and the Benton County District Attorney's Office to house the position and to make the position available to any elected DA in the state of Oregon that wants to use my services. So what that means is if somebody wants to bring me in as a special prosecutor on one of these cases, it doesn't add cost to the home office. It doesn't add any cost to that office, which a major issue with these cases is they tend to be resource heavy. They tend to be result in trials and lots of negotiations. And with an average district attorney and deputy district attorney's workload, it's hard to take the time to really treat these cases with the time and respect that they're due. So I come at no cost to the DAs that use me. I do use the Benton County District Attorney's Office as my home office. However, I work for the most part either on the road or from my home office in Portland. I started, as I said, in September 2013. I renewed what is a yearly contract in September of 2014. I've been sworn in as a deputy district attorney. I never dreamed that I'd be able to say this, but in 16 of Oregon's 36 counties. I have worked as a deputy district attorney on over 50 cases on every stage of a case. So some counties have brought me in on cases that already were in the pipeline, that had already been existing before I started. Some counties have called me for advice. What do we do at the beginning of this case? Some counties have brought me in somewhere in the middle. I've taken cases through grand jury. I have prosecuted felony cases, misdemeanor cases, and have resolved cases that have resulted in no prosecution, what we call no complaints in the criminal justice world. I've also assisted law enforcement and deputy DAs in counties where I haven't actually been sworn in, but they've had a question. How do we deal with charging this case? How do we deal with forfeiture? And I've become something of a subject matter expert in this area for people in the state and actually a few people out of the state, although I have to tell them frankly that I can't give them legal advice out of the state because I don't know anything about their laws. But I've definitely talked strategy with prosecutors in other states. I've also given presentations to DAs here, law enforcement groups, animal rescue groups, and other interested groups, including Willamette Law School students, Lewis and Clark Law School students, and Oregon University of Oregon undergraduate class. Proud to be speaking at my alma mater, Lewis and Clark Law School's symposium coming up in a couple of months on this issue as well. I prosecuted the first animal neglect felony in Oregon that actually went to trial, State versus Robert Silver in Polk County this past year. Mr. Silver, after neglecting over 100 head of alpaca, went to trial, was convicted on two felony counts and 16 misdemeanor counts, and received a 36-month prison sentence. So I believe the first person to be sent to prison in the state of Oregon for animal neglect solely. And through this all, I've raised significant amounts of media attention on the issue of animal cruelty, abuse, and neglect. Representative Barker, you were quoted in the article in the Willamette Week that significantly and sort of embarrassingly raised my profile, and certainly other local newspapers and national newspapers have picked up those stories and have run them, and I'm happy and proud to have been able to do that in the state of Oregon. So that's sort of my overview of the position. How I came to it is at the Multnomah County DA's office. You work in all sorts of different kinds of cases. You start in the misdemeanors, you work your way up, and as you go through, you handle all different kinds of cases, DUIIs, disorderly conducts, abuse cases, assault cases, and animal cruelty cases. And it just so happened when I was at the DA's office in Multnomah County, I handled several cases that could be termed as hoarding cases. So these were cases where people had way too many domestic animals. They had not taken the steps that they needed to provide those animals with minimum care, and they had it had just gotten out of hand. And through those cases, some legal issues came up, and when a prosecutor has legal issues in an animal cruelty case, they go to the Animal Legal Defense Fund. We're lucky enough in Oregon to have them as a resource just right there, readily available. And Scott Heiser and his team helped me out on a couple of different legal issues, so I got to know them, so that when the job came open, I thought, you know, I have some familiarity with that area of law. This sounds like an interesting opportunity, and I'd be happy to give it a shot. So that's how I come to the position. It's the long way around of answering your question.
Thank you.
And I understood the committee wanted a little bit of background on animal cruelty laws in Oregon, so I've put together a really, really broad strokes picture of it. This does not cover everything, and it's not in detail, but typically speaking, animal cruelty breaks down into abuse and neglect. And abuse is when you're thinking about somebody who's actively taking an opportunity to hurt an animal through their action or their reckless action. That includes abuse in the second degree all the way up to aggravated animal abuse and sexual assault. There are abuse charges that are misdemeanors. There are abuse charges that are felonies. And generally speaking, you have to cause some degree of physical injury or serious physical injury to an animal or kill them in some malicious or cruel way to be charged and convicted of animal abuse. Then there's animal neglect, and the keystone of animal neglect in Oregon law is failure to provide minimum care. So minimum care is defined very helpfully in the statute. They have a list of things. It's not an exhaustive list, but it's an extensive list. You have to, under the law, provide your animal with sufficient food and water and veterinary care and shelter in some cases. And if you fail to do that, even with criminal negligence, you can be found guilty of animal neglect. And as you know, animal neglect, there was an added felony charge of animal neglect that came up in Senate Bill 6 a couple of years ago. And the factors that make an animal neglect a felony have to do with the number of animals neglected, have to do with the whether a person has certain prior convictions, and also can have to do with whether a person committed the neglect in the presence of a minor or not. And animal neglect broken down into several degrees, and then there's felonies, and then also animal abandonment, which is illegal in Oregon, has to do with neglect as well. There's also a prohibition against possession. I just want to touch on this really briefly. If you are convicted of a crime, and I've listed them out there in the PowerPoint, statutorily you are prohibited from possession of domestic animals or an animal of the same genus as the crime was committed against for the next 5 or 15 years. And I have an asterisk there, both because there's a 15-year sort of enhanced penalty for committing aggravated animal abuse, dog fighting, cockfighting, or felony animal abuse. Also, just to remind myself that there are a number of exceptions to this prohibition against possession that actually got put into place in Senate Bill 6, and those have to do with people who are qualified as commercial livestock operators and their first conviction, or they can petition the court if they believe themselves to have been a commercial livestock operator prior to the act having been committed. If you violate this, it is a Class C misdemeanor, so it's the lowest class of criminal conviction, but it is a law, and if you violate it, obviously you may be in violation of your probation conditions, which may end you up back in front of a judge if you've been convicted. Pretrial forfeiture is a major issue in these cases that I had not really considered before I started this work. Essentially, the issue is this. Law enforcement goes in on a search warrant. They seize a number of sick, neglected, or abused animals, and then they have to keep those animals, and they have to provide minimum care for those animals all the way through to the end of a case. And what the legislature has done, which is great, is put this this specific law in place, which allows the district attorney or the animal care agency that is caring for these animals to petition the court for pretrial forfeiture. And the law does several things. It makes sure that the animals can go to their home. They don't have to stay in county possession or in a rented situation that is not ideal for the animals, even while their former owners are on trial for animal cruelty, which, as we all know, trials can stretch out, especially felony trials. The calendar on it can get into the months, the years. I had a trial that started as a criminal case in 2009. It was appealed, it came back, and then I tried it in 2014. So that's 5 years. And they did do the forfeiture on the front end, or you can imagine the bills that would have piled up. And that brings me to the second point, which is that reduces the cost of care by the people who are tasked with caring for these animals and giving them at minimum treatment, and you would hope more than minimum treatment because they're the government. In addition, it doesn't take away from the presumption of innocence because nothing that judge decides says anything one way or the other about whether this particular person committed the act. The statute is actually very clearly written not to implicate any particular person in neglecting or abusing the animal. It just says the animal was subjected to a violation of the law. So it doesn't take away from the presumption of innocence. You're actually not even deciding that at this point. And it allows for, not only does it not take away from, it allows for due process because all interested parties in the ownership of these animals get an opportunity to be heard. They get notice, they can cross-examine witnesses, they can make arguments, and they can resolve the issue of ownership of the animals before any criminal trial has had a chance to stretch out the timeline. The factors that go into this are that there is a criminal case pending, the animal has to have been impounded and held by an animal control agency or the county, animal care agency, excuse me. Notice has to be given, and there's a notice provision in the law that gives a really clear way of complying. And the final thing is that even if the judge orders forfeiture, says this animal should be forfeited because it was subjected to this violation, the judge has to, by law, establish a bond amount. And what that bond amount does is it allows somebody to put up the money to care for the animal until the trial happens. So they can avoid the forfeiture happening. But what that does is it relieves the burden of the cost on the animal care agency or the county, and it allows them to draw from that bond money so everybody can have it both ways. The animal can still not have been decided as to whether it's going to be forfeited, but it doesn't cost the county anything extra. At least that's the idea. So it's an excellent tool to use to make sure that these cases don't just get running with costs and then end up bankrupting one party or leaving these animals in the lurch, so to speak. That's all the prepared information I have. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Are there any questions, Mr. Kamens? Thank you very much for your information. That was a good presentation.
Thank you so much. Oh, I did. I don't want to be remiss, and I did. I was called by the Oregon District Attorneys Association late yesterday, and asked to voice their support for the three animal-related bills that are on your docket today: the nuisance bill, the encouraging sexual assault of an animal, and the bill adding the language to the coercion statute. So I just wanted to pass that along. I think that they were scrambling to try to find somebody to cover that issue for them. So thank you.
Close the informational meeting. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2888.
Mr. Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2888 is sponsored by Representative Witt. We have no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact on this bill. The bill is ready to move. We have no amendments before us today. Current Oregon law contains provisions to address the abatement of nuisance activities or conditions. Places and activities addressed under current law include prostitution, patronizing a prostitute, gambling, lottery, properties determined not fit for use and in need of decontamination, as well as any place involving the unauthorized delivery, manufacturing, or possession of a controlled substance. House Bill 2888 adds to this existing list places used for crimes against animals.
Laura Dunn, Glenn Kolb, and Sharon Harmon.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Laura Dunn, and I am a staff attorney for the Animal Legal Defense Fund. I work in the Criminal Justice Program. We would first like to thank Representative Witt for sponsoring House Bill 2888 and for the support of my colleagues, the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association, the Oregon Humane Society, the Humane Society of the United States, and ODAA, to name a few. By way of background, as has already been mentioned, ALDF is a national nonprofit organization of attorneys. We specialize in protecting the interests of animals, and our criminal justice program is based in Portland, and we provide free support to prosecutors nationwide. First, if I may, I'd like to point you to the fact sheet in your materials that we hope will just give you a quick snapshot of what this bill does, what it does not do, why we need it, and then also some safeguards that are already in place in the current nuisance abatement structure. So to begin, what does this bill do? Well, Oregon has had a nuisance abatement structure on the books for decades. Currently, illegal activity that qualifies as a nuisance includes prostitution, illegal gambling, and drug dealing. And the citizen in the community where one of these nuisances is occurring can take steps to abate the nuisance to stop the criminal conduct from occurring. So all that this bill does is add animal crimes that are already on the books, already illegal, and adds those crimes to the list of the nuisance category, which can be found in ORS 105-555. So we're talking about crimes that Mr. Kamens just mentioned, abuse, neglect, fighting, to name a few. So crimes that are already on the books regarding animals. So to be clear, this bill does not create any new animal-related crimes. It simply adds another tool for addressing animal cruelty in our communities. So why do we need this bill? The link has already been discussed here today. Our criminal justice system is not perfect, to say the least. And even with the strong laws that we have on the books here in Oregon, too often that system fails animal victims who suffer without that suffering being addressed in a timely manner. Our law enforcement works extremely hard throughout Oregon, but many departments face resource constraints that limit their ability to respond in a timely manner to animal crimes. So House Bill 2888 allows private citizens to fill this enforcement gap. A citizen can file a complaint seeking to address the nuisance, but it's important to note that only a court, after reviewing all of the evidence, can decide whether to enjoin a nuisance involving animal victims. And as Mr. Kamens also already mentioned, this legislature has codified the importance of addressing the animal suffering in the state by saying that, quote, animals are sentient beings capable of experiencing pain, stress, and fear, and should be cared for in ways that minimize pain, stress, fear, and suffering. So the question might be asked, how do we prevent abuse of this nuisance abatement system? Well, first, as I mentioned, there are already checks in place in the current nuisance abatement structure that the court and only the court can determine whether an animal crime is a nuisance and actually rule to abate that nuisance. There is also an attorney's fees clause for prevailing parties, and there are sanctions in place for attorneys who might bring frivolous claims. In addition, I must emphasize again that under this bill, only conduct relating to animals that is already unlawful would be considered a nuisance. So all the exemptions from the current cruelty code would apply. This is because by incorporating existing animal crimes, this bill also incorporates all of those exemptions in the cruelty code. And I have included that list in a footnote on page 4 of ALDF's written testimony. Finally, after decades on the books, there are no known abuses of the current nuisance abatement system. So to conclude, House Bill 2888 is an important tool to combating animal suffering in our communities, which the legislature has deemed to be an important policy. This legislature has already put in place a functioning nuisance abatement system. We ask only that existing animal crimes be added to the list of other illegal activities that constitute a nuisance so that animal suffering can be addressed in a more timely manner than the criminal justice system often allows. Thank you for your time.
Okay, and I'll just ask the question up front. So this clearly does not interfere with animal husbandry practices.
That is correct, and that is because this bill incorporates exemptions already in the cruelty code. Yes.
Chair Mark.
Yes.
On that list, I don't see the one that I was concerned about, because for now it's socially acceptable. Horse racing, greyhound racing. Could that be considered a nuisance under this bill?
Chair Barker, Representative Post, this bill, as I said, incorporates all of the current exemptions to the cruelty code.
I'm reading that right now, and I don't see that one.
Yes, and my understanding is that that list does not include racing at this time.
So horse racing is, you lost me, sorry. It's exempt or it's not exempt?
It is currently legal, and therefore it would not be considered a nuisance under this bill. It is not a specifically listed exemption in the cruelty code, but it is legal, and therefore could not be considered a nuisance under this bill.
Okay, follow up. Okay, we're getting run out of time.
I know, and I'm the guy that's running up against clock. I just want to make sure, is this, you know, the camel's nose under the tent to go there?
Chair Barker, Representative Post, no, it is not.
Okay, thank you. And please, we are just running a little short time, so if we could, I don't want to short you from any testimony at all, but please go ahead.
Representative Barker, members of the committee, I'm Sharon Harmon. I'm the director of the Oregon Humane Society in Portland, Oregon, an independent animal welfare agency. We support House Bill 2888.
Okay, thank you.
My name is Glenn Kolb, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm executive director with the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association, 1,000 veterinary members across the state in all aspects of veterinary disciplines. We also support 2888. A similar law on nuisance abatement that includes animals is in effect in North Carolina. I've talked with my colleague there, asked her if they've had any raised concerns among their veterinary community. There have not been, which is important to us. I guess as we look at it, this does give us an additional means to address animal cruelty and neglect. Veterinarians on the front line, we treat them all the time. And so if you are meeting good standards of care, appropriate animal husbandry, there won't be any actions taken against you. But if you fail to meet your obligations and responsibilities with care of animals, or if you willfully ignore agreement with local authorities to do so, action may be taken against. As we find that to be reasonable, appropriate, that's why we support the bill and encourage your support too.
Okay, and I have one question. So you said attorney's fees. So if somebody brings, if I complain about a neighbor and get charges brought and it turns out that they're innocent, then I would pay their attorney's fees. Is that correct?
Chair Barker, yes, there is a provision within the current nuisance abatement system that allows the court at its discretion to award those fees to the prevailing party.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment for the committee. Nuisance actions are relatively rare. I once did one and got in an injunction. It had nothing to do with animals. But it's actually pretty hard to go in and get an injunction for nuisance. It's not something that you have to go in for a court, a special hearing, et cetera. They don't just enjoin activity for nuisance willy-nilly. So I feel pretty comfortable with this bill.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions?
Yeah, okay. So, Warren, I guess page 2 of the bill, line 17, talks about possessing, controlling, or otherwise having charge at the same time of more than 50 sexually intact dogs. How'd you land on 50?
Interesting.
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, all of the language that you see in the bill, including the language that you mentioned here, is taken from existing law in Oregon's cruelty code, and this relates to a breeding law currently on the books.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
51, you're in trouble.
Representative Olson, that was the 09 puppy mill bill.
Yeah, I got it. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, panel. Appreciate your testimony. Gail can come on up, and Scott Beckstead. Why don't we have Scott go ahead and go first?
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For all the reasons that have already been stated, the Humane Society of the United States is strongly in support of House Bill 2888. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
He needs to introduce himself. Sorry.
He did.
Oh, it's my mistake.
Oh, I don't know if I did.
He did. He said
very well.
Who is it?
Scott Beckstead.
Can't you see?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We are neutral on the bill. I just was reading it closely, and I just wanted to point out one thing if anybody was equally as concerned. If you look on Section 2, Line 9, any place being used on a continuous, regular, or sporadic basis, and then down to Line 16, failure to provide minimum care. So it would allow on the face of the bill sporadically providing minimum care. The other subsections really talk about egregious affirmative conduct, causing physical injury, causing serious physical injury, killing or maliciously torturing. What we know about our clients that fail to provide minimum care, there's very frequently a mental health component to that. They're hoarders. They don't do it maliciously. So I just point that out. It would allow for a nuisance, which, granted, I think Representative Barton's comments well taken, hard to get, but on its face it would allow for sporadically failing to provide minimum care to support a nuisance abatement. So,
okay, thank you. Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, we had a cockfighting bill.
Yeah, that's illegal.
In what year was that? 2009.
Peter Courtney did one. It was attending the cockfight, I remember.
Yeah,
we had
later.
One before that.
Yeah.
One of the concerns was that some of the paraphernalia that maybe a grandfather had. In fact, they had a chest here. They opened it up, and it had the little things and this and that. And this paraphernalia that was 100 and some years old. And I thought that we had an exemption for that pre-existing paraphernalia that's used in cockfighting or dogfighting or anything else that was an antique handed down through the family. Obviously, that stuff hadn't been used in 50 years or more. And I see that I need to check to see whether the original bill that we did allowed for that exemption of those items.
Use it for cockfighting, that it be used for cockfighting.
Okay, so it's prohibited with the intent to use it. So if you're not intending to use it, it wouldn't be, I believe. Would that be correct?
Which line?
It's on page 2, line 2, 23.
At the end of page 2, line 22,
it specifies that there would need to be intent to use those items for fighting.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a totally fair question to you. I should have asked this to the earlier panel because I keep trying to wrap my head around this. So what is listed here in a most of in Section 2 here are behaviors that are already illegal. So we know we can't do those things. What are we trying to get at by adding the nuisance element?
Sure. Chair Barker, Representative Springer, I would definitely defer to the experts in the Animal Legal Defense Fund, but with my my own history in a practicing lawyer, as well as my experience with the Humane Society in taking cruelty complaints, I get a lot of calls from all over the state from individuals who are concerned about what they perceive as animal cruelty, and a lot of those complaints are coming from neighbors who, you know, every day are seeing something that they believe is unlawful. And so, of course, what I try to do is point them to the appropriate law enforcement resources. And unfortunately, especially given the current state of county budgets, sometimes there just aren't the resources for law enforcement to give these kinds of cases the attention that they deserve. And so this provides an additional tool to make sure that the animal cruelty code is being followed in Oregon. Does that answer your question?
Kind of. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I'm sorry. Representative Greenlee.
Yeah,
please.
I think Ms. Myers may read this issue, but I'm still a little confused about line one. I'm page one, line 12. Line 11, which talks about whether or not carried out with a particular mental state. What does that mean? I wonder if somebody could help me with that.
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, I would probably direct that. Thank you.
Yeah. Good. Here comes somebody. Yeah.
Chair Barker, Representative.
Identify yourself again, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Laura Dunn with the Animal Legal Defense Fund, staff attorney for the Criminal Justice Program. Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, this bill incorporates the crimes that are already in Oregon's cruelty code, including the mental states, so that would be incorporated automatically from the current law.
Well, then maybe you can tell me what current law says is going in here, what with or without a particular mental state means. I mean, with or without a particular mental state means mental state isn't relevant to this. Is that right?
Yeah.
And if so, why is it in it?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, the mental state for the current cruelty code would apply to that particular crime.
Well, the bill we looked at a bit ago on sexual abuse of an animal talks about it. It has a specificity about the mental state. Does this change that? Does this say under that case the mental state was for the purpose of arousal or something, which is a mental state, I assume.
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, whatever the mental state is for that current crime, for example, page 1, line 14, killing maliciously, as defined in ORS 167322, whatever the mental state is for that particular crime, if it is found that a nuisance is occurring regarding that crime, the mental state from that statute, 167322, would apply.
But it says without regard to that.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to. Can I take a crack at it, if I may? So, great. I love having Representative Greenlick on this committee, by the way. So, this is my understanding, for whatever it's worth. So, in criminal law, state of mind is very relevant. You have to intend to do it. That's, however, a nuisance action is not a criminal action. It's a civil action. In fact, it comes from equity, and it's actually one of the oldest actions that arises in law. It dates back to the Middle Ages when one neighbor was doing something that affected the property rights of another. It's kind of how equity arose in part. Mm-hmm. And so what it's saying, let's pretend, I'm going to just throw out a hypothetical. Let's pretend like your neighbor was having sporadic cockfights at the house, and the police could never quite prove it. You could enjoin this, you could seek an injunction based on the nuisance, but you wouldn't have to prove, unlike a prosecutor who's trying to deprive someone of liberty, and they would have to prove that they intended to do a cockfight, you wouldn't have to prove intent, just that it was happening, and that would be a basis for an injunction. Is it? That's my best understanding, anyway.
Chair Barker, this is Gail Meyer. I would agree with what Representative Barton says, that that's the way it reads, but I don't understand that that's consistent with, I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
Laura Dunn.
Laura Dunn. I don't hear that what Correct. You just said is consistent with what Ms. Dunn said.
That's possible.
And I think it is a confusing phrase. When I read the bill, I thought it meant that they didn't need to show any mental state at all.
I think it does say that.
Yeah.
If there's a nuisance, you know, that it doesn't, you don't have to find them. I mean, you're dealing with the nuisance, not with the...
Right, but I think Ms. Dunn was testifying that they did. So I think that's confusing.
Chair Barker, representatives on the committee, if I could, as has already been said, this is a civil nuisance abatement system, so not criminal. So as Representative Barton has put forth, we're not talking about a prosecutor that would have to prove a certain mental state.
President Krieger,
can I have you answer how many cases you would think would come forward in a year?
Representative Barker, Representative Krieger, I can't. I apologize. I can't speculate on how many cases would possibly come through. In chatting with some of my colleagues, for example, the case that Mr. Kamens mentioned regarding Robert Silver that involved quite a large number of alpaca. Those animals, my understanding is that those animals suffered for a very long period of time prior to the criminal justice system being able to step in and address that situation. So that's just one instance in which the nuisance abatement structure might have been of aid to those animals. So we certainly see an abundance of animal cruelty crimes every single day coming through our office, DA's offices throughout the state. So this, again, would just be one more tool in addressing that.
Okay.
Just wondering about whether or not all these things have to come before a judge at some point, even a nuisance abatement. Did we have any revenue impact?
No. There's no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact on this bill.
Okay, thank you, panel. Kathy Fest and Roger Beyer, please.
Good afternoon. For the record, Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau. Oregon Farm Bureau has concerns with 2888. For one, these are activities that are already illegal in law, and so we feel like this legislation to make them a nuisance is unnecessary. But I think our larger concern comes from the fact that this opens up a door for nuisance lawsuits between landowners and risks put forth on livestock producers. When a neighboring landowner believes there's a perceived animal cruelty and the prosecutor locally does not agree with that opinion. And we even heard on the previous panel the quote from the Humane Society that they get calls from people for what they perceive is animal cruelty. And that's the concern we have. If the committee is interested in moving the legislation forward, we would ask for an amendment to clarify that animal husbandry practices are not subject to these nuisance lawsuits. And we have been in discussions with the sponsor, Representative Witt, and believe those amendments are being drafted up.
Okay, great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer here, representing Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. I agree with what Katie just said, but I'd also like to point to the previous debate you just had amongst yourselves as to this bill. You heard in testimony that this bill does not expand the list of statutes that are constitute animal abuse. But I think by Representative Barton's testimony that whether or not carried out with a particular mental state and his clarification of that, it clearly does expand that, because in the animal abuse statutes, you have to prove that mental state. This means you don't have to prove that mental state in order to bring a nuisance suit. So therefore, we see it clearly as expanding the list of potential claims in that arena if you don't have to make that mental state proof. So we would agree with Katie's testimony that if you're going to move this forward, we need a very clear animal husbandry exception to this nuisance statute. I would also point to, and again, this isn't a dairy farmer's issue per se, but some of the local processing facilities around, maybe some neighbors don't necessarily like the processing of chickens or pigs or whatever happens to be in the backyard processing world, but clearly there would be animals being harmed there, in that you can hardly process a chicken or pig without harming it first. Therefore, I think you may need to look at that as another issue. So, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. I got to move.
No problem.
Okay. We are not going to move it today, so I'll talk with the representative about it.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing. Open a quick hearing on House Bill 3468. I apologize for the rush, but I be before the speaker here in a few minutes.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 3468 is sponsored by Representative Williamson. We have not all the paperwork back on this, so I will leave it to witnesses to describe the bill.
Okay, Lynn Fairweather, Aaron Greenwald, and Sharon Harmon.
Good afternoon, Representative Barker, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Greenwald. I'm the Domestic Violence Resource Prosecutor for the Oregon Department of Justice. I want to thank Representative Williamson for sponsoring this proposition, which just proposes a minimum change to a current existing law, which is coercion. I know that we're rushed for a little bit for time. Coercion is essentially making somebody do something that they have a legal right not to do, or keeping somebody from doing something that they have a legal right not to do by instilling them a fear that certain things are going to happen. And currently, under Oregon law, there's a long list of things that if they instill in a person a fear of something that's going to happen, then it's a Class C felony. What this bill proposes to do is just add to that language that unlawfully threatening to unlawfully cause physical injury to some animal would be a part of the coercion bill. The reason that this is important is because threats like this and actual abuse towards animals happens all the time in this state in the context of domestic violence relationships. I just want to give you a few examples of recent cases that my colleagues have prosecuted. For example, one domestic violence defendant beat his girlfriend's dog with a broken chair leg until his girlfriend, who was pregnant at the time, threw her body across the dog to protect it. Another domestic violence perpetrator kicked and bit his girlfriend's dog. When she tried to intervene, he assaulted her. Another defendant abused his girlfriend's cat so badly, hitting and choking it, that she felt she had no choice but to give the cat away to protect it. And finally, another one that was told to me just yesterday was that another defendant beat his girlfriend's puppy so severely that the puppy's eyeball popped out, and he left the puppy dying in its bed so that the girlfriend would find it. These perpetrators are not only abusing these animals, of course, they're threatening to abuse these animals. And it's just one way among an infinite number of ways that perpetrators gain and maintain control over the victims. In a survey of 48 domestic violence shelters across the nation, 85% of shelter directors encountered cases where women had disclosed animal abuse. Other studies have found that anywhere from 54 to 86% of women in DV shelters have reported that their pet has been hurt or killed. Unfortunately, though, it's oftentimes the pet that keeps the women in the homes, because especially in Oregon, but across the nation, there are very few domestic violence shelters that have the ability to house pets. So women, who sometimes their only source of comfort and safety is that pet, are very unwilling to leave that pet in the home, especially knowing what the perpetrator can do to it. Prosecutors have some ability to hold offenders accountable when they physically abuse the victim's pet to the point of physical injury, although the abuse, animal abuse statutes, as you've seen, are by and large mostly misdemeanors. We have very little ability to hold the defendant accountable when the defendant chronically abuses the pet in a way that doesn't show up as physical injury. So kicks it, hits it, throws it, does whatever it does, it doesn't show up as physical injury. These threats, the threats that perpetrators make towards the defendant's pets, have a significant impact on the victim's autonomy and oftentimes absolutely prevents the victim from being able to leave. So making this what seems like a minor change to the coercion statute would actually tremendously help prosecutors hold perpetrators accountable, and most importantly, it would help us to improve the safety of victims and those of their pets. Thank you very much.
So, members, can you stay around just for a few more minutes? I think we're about done. Representative Krieger, I know you got to go. So.
Gotta go.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm here.
Members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify in support of HB 3468. It's my privilege to be here. I'll be brief. My name is Lynn Fairweather. I own a company called Presage Consulting and Training, which specializes in domestic violence threat assessment and management. I work with both the public and private sector, and I've worked in the domestic violence response and prevention field for the past 22 years. Throughout my work, I've seen many examples of why this bill matters, and I'm here today to share with you three main reasons why I support it. The first one is in regard to victim safety. As mentioned, victims of domestic violence are often isolated by their abusers, and pets may offer the only remaining emotional support they have. Abusers will use anything their victim cares about to gain leverage, and that leaves pets distinctly at risk, being that they're excluded from the current coercion law. Like children, they are loved by the victim, smaller than the abuser, and they can't speak up about what's happening. Unfortunately, this makes them the perfect target through which the abuser can coerce their primary victim without legal consequence. As mentioned, many shelters and hotels do not accept pets, a fact that leaves victims in a position of having to choose between their pet's safety and their own. Sadly, this frequently results in them staying or returning to dangerous situations. The second reason I support this bill is in regard to my knowledge of domestic violence perpetrators. From a threat assessment perspective, abuse of animals is a glaring red flag. It is an indicator of psychopathy, and there is evidence to support the idea that people who victimize animals are also very likely to victimize other human beings, including children. Adding animal abuse to the crime of coercion allows us to identify more of these offenders at an earlier stage and gives us more tools that we can use to deter abusive actions and hold accountable those who would commit them. Lastly, these are important reasons to support this bill, but the more important personally to me, the more important reason that I'm here today is because of a dog named Tiva. Tiva was my 120-pound Rottweiler Doberman mix who wouldn't hurt a fly. She was physically and verbally assaulted by my abuser, just as I was. In fact, more than once, my abuser threatened to kill her and would sometimes psychologically torture me by hiding her and telling me he had already killed her. At the time, I couldn't find an affordable apartment that allowed dogs, so I stayed in the home for as long as I could. And when I finally did leave, it was without her, but I promised her I would come back, and a few months later, I did. The story ends well for Tiva and I, but I cannot still reconcile the fact that when my abuser chose to use an innocent as a pawn and use her as a tool to terrorize me, what he did would not have been considered a crime under our current Oregon law. I urge you to do right by animal victims like Tiva and their abused owners as well by passing this bill so that all of the victims of domestic violence are protected in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Okay. Sharon?
My name is Sharon Harmon. I'm the director of the Oregon Humane Society. I just want to make sure that this committee understands that we are not affiliated with the Humane Society of the United States, and that other agencies that use the term Humane Society are likely not affiliated with us. We are an independent one organization facility. I am in support of this bill, and I really can't top the testimony you've just heard other than to say that we know that people will not leave their pets. We saw it in Hurricane Katrina. We see people put their lives at risk. We hear of domestic violence victims who call out about the welfare of the animal in their home with an abusive partner before they reach out for help for themselves. We are often the agency that investigates the stomping of the kitten, the throwing of the dog against the wall, the beating of the animal, because it relates to the care of the animal, and it really is violence against the woman in the house, and it's the animals that pay for it with their lives. We're in support of House Bill 3468. We'd appreciate your support as well.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think that's it. Okay, so I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 3468, and we are adjourned. And we are adjourned.